very much. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, fine. Welcome to this third in the America as Another Country lecture series organized by the Cold War Studies Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm the chair for this evening. My name is Professor Michael Cox in the Department of International Relations here. In the first of our lectures, Paul Rogers and Bill Walforth wondered whether or not the United States was a criminal, an outlaw, a sheriff, a good guy, or a bad guy. Last week, we had a debate between two American politicians, both of whom seemed to agree that Bush was rather a good guy, which was somewhat surprising. And next week, we'll be talking about neoconservatism. And we'll have an interesting debate between Ann Norton and Stephen Halfer on that. But I'm very pleased this evening to welcome two speakers who are not unknown at all, or strangers, to the London School of Economics, Anatole Levin and John Micklethwaite. In the programme, Anatole, on my right here, is down for the Carnegie Endowment, but he's now moved on to bigger, or at least better things, at the New America Foundation, where he is the Senior Research Fellow, and I think Anatole will be going first this evening, to be then followed by John Micklethwaite, who is the US Editor of The Economist. Both Anatole and John have written, I think, really quite important, very important books, in fact, on the United States over the last 2 years. One of which one of which is on sale, and the other one, I'm afraid to say, is not on sale. The one which is on sale, he's afraid. The one which is on sale is Anatole Levin's America, Right or Wrong, which will be signed afterwards for a suitably small fee, and John Micklethwaite and Andrew Woodridge's book on Right Nation, which I'm afraid is not on sale, and he won't be signing it. But anyway, he did write it with Andrew. Well, anyway, with no further ado, I'd like to welcome Anatole to begin the discussion for tonight. Is America a foreign country? With a very big question mark. Reflections on the Right Nation. At least I've got the title of your book in, John, even if it's not on sale tonight. Anatole, over to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. The title, at least in my own mind, has now changed twice, because I expected it to be America is a foreign country, question mark. Then I heard that it was America as a foreign country, and have planned my remarks accordingly. And now it's back to is America a foreign country again. If we were to debate is America a foreign country, well, I was all set up for a real gladiatorial combat here. You know, not just gladiators, but ravenous hippos and lions. But actually, I think on the milder theme, John and I may agree too much. There will be differences of nuance. But if you in the audience want to introduce some hippos and tigers, you're very welcome to do so. I wanted to look at three areas in which America is indeed a very foreign country as regards contemporary Britain. These relate to the economy and the state, to religion, and to nationalism. Now, these areas are, of course, enormous, and we each have 15 minutes, so I don't want anybody in the question and answer period suggesting that I've been superficial on the subject, because I will be superficial on the subject. Anyway, to begin, there's a lot of talk these days of an Anglo-Saxon economic model, supposedly uniting, at least in the minds of its more ideological proponents, not just America and Britain, but even Canada, not a suggestion that would be altogether welcomed by many Canadians, of course, that Canada is Anglo-Saxon, Australia, and so on. The real picture is, of course, as I'm sure you all know, very much more mixed, just as Europe is much more mixed, because this Anglo-Saxon model is presented as differing from a continental European one. And if you know something about American attitudes to many critical aspects of the state's role in society and the economy, it must surely be entirely clear that while Britain, to some degree, occupies a position between parts of Europe and the United States, in critical areas it is still much closer to one or other of the European models than it is to America. And this relates especially to the fields of social welfare and to health coverage. Now, this absence of a modern, or to a very great extent, absence of a modern welfare state in America, is related to a historically critical aspect of American society, which, until relatively recently, made America very different from Britain. Britain may, in future, become much more like America, but we're certainly not there yet. That is, of course, the fact that America has historically been an immigrant society. And to put it at its bluntest, but I think it's perfectly obvious in American history, the traditional white, I mean previously white Anglo-Saxon, Protestant or German populations of the countryside and the small towns, now the suburbs, the small towns, and to a much lesser extent the countryside, felt no basic sense of solidarity with the populations of the American cities. At least once these cities had come to be dominated in the 19th century by very largely non-Protestant immigrants with radically different religious cultures. For a while, in the middle decades of the 20th century, that changed when the immigrant populations or the former immigrant populations in the cities gained a sufficient grip on the American political system to turn America from that point of view into something much more like Europe, where politics has for a long time now been dominated by the cities. But that really only lasted until those populations themselves moved out again to the all-white suburbs and began to adopt the precisely the same attitudes to the cities which their white Anglo-Saxon Protestant predecessors had. We have had a tremendous reminder of this, of course, in recent months with the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And the question which has been raised in American, the American media, but to some extent in Europe as well, as to whether this will awaken some kind of new attitude to the welfare state as far as the inner cities are concerned on the part of the white majority has been answered, as far as I'm concerned, again and again in modern history. It won't. Now, of course, as I say, we could be becoming more like America in this regard. Europe as a whole could be, in terms of immigration and the alienation between older populations and new immigrants. I mean, we have had, of course, some very searing lessons in Europe in recent months in this regard. But once again, we're not there yet. Now, attitudes to the state and the economy and the role of the state in the economy, different attitudes in America, very different from us, are related to an even deeper difference, which is the nature of the United States system as in some ways an early modern or late medieval system rather than a modern system in the European sense. Now, you may well think that this reflects the view of some radical anti-American, savage, wild man from the fringes of the European left. It does not. It reflects a fascinating essay by Samuel Huntington, an American conservative, as I hardly need stress, from 1969, in which, with a great deal of a very sophisticated historical argument, he pointed out that many of the fundamentals of the American system were laid down in the 17th century before the modernization and centralization of the British and European states, and then carried on in many ways, not unchanged, of course, but less changed in Europe after that. Now, Huntington was talking about, above all, about the distribution of powers in the American system. But in my view, it is even more true of American attitudes to patronage, both in terms of government jobs, but also in terms of relations between the American state and the economy and private business. 17th and 18th century attitudes to the distribution of patronage in terms of jobs are absolutely obvious. Every time an American administration changes, at least changes between the parties, around 3,500 jobs in the American bureaucracy change hands, because the new administration fills them up completely legally, accepted by everybody, with its own appointments. This is England in a former age. It's not Britain today. It is very, very different. I mean, as to the effects on American government and competence, that's, you know, subject for a different debate. Connected with this is a very different attitude to relations between American politics and government and business. And one can find no better example of this fact than what happened to Mr. Blunkett recently in Britain. What he did would hardly have been noticed in America. It certainly could not possibly have been grounds to force him out of a government office. One would have to go very, very much further than this. Now, this doesn't reflect some kind of innate corruption in the American system. What it reflects, in my view, is a very different history. In part, as I say, the impact of America being in some ways a much more continuous political system than Britain. As Huntington also pointed out, don't forget that America has by far the oldest constitution, the oldest political system, the oldest political parties anywhere in the world. We think of America as a new, young country. It isn't. It's a very old country by European standards from this point of view. So in some ways this is a continuation, once again, of attitudes from England before the modernization of government under the Victorians. It also, however, reflects a critical difference, obviously, between Britain and North America, which is that at least since the great seizures of Irish land in the 17th century, Britain has not been a country with enormous areas of unclaimed land, enormous unclaimed natural resources, belonging to nobody except, of course, the Red Indians, and therefore up for grabs. Technically owned by the American state, but actually there to be taken from the state or given by the state to anybody who could exploit them. Now, the legitimacy of this in the American system comes from the fact that they did exploit them very successfully. The railroads took enormous amounts of state land, but they built the railroads, and not just the railroads, but great cities. The connection between the robber barons of the late 19th and early 20th centuries and more or less corrupt links to the state are well known. But these people built modern America in economic terms. In other words, at a fundamental level, this isn't seen as illegitimate in terms of the American tradition, because it worked. Now, whether this is still appropriate in the very different American economy of today, that's another question for another debate. But if you're interested in looking at some of the history of this, particularly in the context of the origins of Halliburton, and how from its very inception it was intimately linked to state contracts, there's a fascinating biography of Lyndon Johnson by Robert Caro, which describes the way in which the rise of Lyndon Johnson and the rise of one of Halliburton's key elements, Brown and Root in Texas, were intimately linked from the very beginning. So, once again, a critical difference there between America and Britain today. The second element, the second major column, if you like, religion. Now, this is extremely obvious. I mean, I think, just the most superficial look at America. There is simply no parallel in Western Europe today between the level of Christian religiosity in America and that in Europe, except to some degree in Northern Ireland, from which, of course, many American Protestants originally came. Now, of course, it's not true of all Americans, but in 1996, of course, there have been more recent surveys, it was just the first one I could lay my hands on, 66% of Americans said that they had made a personal commitment to Jesus Christ, and one-third of the population went to church once a week. Another third went to church approximately once a month. And wherever and whenever in modern history, or indeed in history altogether, there has been deep religious faith in a society, that has inevitably and logically had profound effects on politics, on political attitudes, on political programs. Because deep religious faith, by its very nature, carries with it profound convictions about what constitutes a decent society and a good society. Now, one mustn't, of course, exaggerate the proportion in American society of Christian fundamentalism. Nonetheless, in 1998, 56% of Americans said that they would not vote for an atheist for president. Michael Lind, a colleague of mine at the New America Foundation, pointed out that it's pretty unlikely that in America today a politician with the basically deist, or certainly very loosely Christian in formal terms, attitudes of Abraham Lincoln could in fact be elected, at least certainly not by very large numbers of Americans. The proportion of the American population as a whole, which can be viewed as fundamentalist, is probably no more than 12% at the most. But, of course, because of the political apathy of much of the American population, because of the way that the party system works, as we've seen in the cases of other small but powerful lobbies in America, this gives them a quite disproportionate role in the Republican Party. And in 2001, the last year once again for which I could find figures, the Christian Coalition, the main vehicle of the Christian right in politics, did a survey of the US Congress. And according to its estimate, 29 senators out of 100 and 125 representatives out of 435, in other words, between a quarter and a third, voted 100% of the time in accordance with the principles of the Christian, as laid down formally by the Christian Coalition. So, I mean, that is a pretty substantial level of influence, and once again, quite different from anything in Europe. Now, when I say different, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's worse, necessarily. We may have to discover in Europe in future something about the possibly essential role of religion when it comes to social solidarity, social cohesion, social values. Secondly, I'm not saying that Europe is the rule and America is somehow a weird exception. This is the attitude, by the way, not merely of many Europeans, but of many American liberals as well. There is a certain instinctive tendency, I know I had it in the past, to believe that not merely is God dead, but Max Weber has replaced him. In other words, the gospel of the inevitable disenchantment of the world through modernization applies always and everywhere, with, of course, some weird but small exceptions, right? Like the United States. Not true at all if you look around much of the world today outside Europe. So we need to keep in mind, not just in terms of the great sweep of human history, but even in the world today, the Americans may be the rule and we may be the exception. On the other hand, once again, whether they're the rule and we're the exception or whatever, they're certainly different today, America as a whole. Thirdly, nationalism. Once again, I mean, quite obvious if you look at America today compared to most of Europe, and Britain too. And Sam Huntingdon and many other scholars have suggested a link between conservative religiosity and nationalism, which is certainly borne out, of course, by surveys of evangelical Christians in America and their attitudes to American nationalism. But it's not just them. In 1999, before 9/11, be it noted, 72% of Americans declared that they were proud of America as a country. That compares to 53% of Britons. You know, and after all, Britons are seen as extremely patriotic by the standards of the developed world, and only 35% of French, by the way. 81% of American youths at that time, once again before 9/11, expressed a desire to serve their country. Now, maybe that is in principle, as the Russians say, of principe, but only 46% of Brits did so. Now, once again, this is very different from Britain today. It's not in itself bad. In my book, I point out that Europe can learn a great deal from the central strand of American nationalism, which is a civic nationalism, which has played a tremendous part in America in assimilating waves of immigrants and attaching them to the American state. And once again, I mean, this is something, a lesson which I think has been rubbed in, or should have, by some of the events of recent months. But I think that it must also be clear from things that we've seen in America since 9/11 that there are also much darker strains in American nationalism. Considerable strains, on the one hand, of an identification of the nation with universal values, values which are good in themselves, democracy, freedom, and so forth, but which in America are identified with the American nation and national power in ways which used to be true of some European countries, but which have generally ceased to be in recent decades, or which have been transferred from individual countries to the European Union as an institution. So in this way, America represents, if you like, our past. There is also, however, clearly a much deeper strain of chauvinist nationalism in America. Not in the sense of chauvinism per se, because by God we have that in Europe too, but an outwardly directed aggressive nationalism, which we've lost. Once again, not because we were better, but because we had it kicked out of us by the catastrophes of 20th century European history, which European culture produced. In the context of relations with the Muslim world and the threat from terrorism, of course, the most dangerous aspect of this kind of American nationalism today, this kind of right-wing nationalism, is its identification not so much with Israel, which in itself is entirely legitimate, but with the Likud approach in Israel, and even, on the part of the Christian right, with the even more extreme programs of the Israeli settlers, which involve, of course, on the part of the American Christian right, an absolute denial of any Palestinian national rights, because their view is that this land was given to Israel by God. Once again, something which you would be very, very hard put to find in Europe. Now, in all these cases, historically speaking, you could say that in origin, this wasn't foreign to Britain at all. In every one of them, including certainly the tradition of Cromwellian Protestantism, if you will, we originated it. But then that was also true of Baron Frankenstein. As we know, his creation eventually left the family, you might say, and wandered off on its own. And Baron Frankenstein was reunited with his beloved creation, only to die in its arms. I think we should perhaps keep that memory in mind as Britons before we suggest that America and Britain are not, in fact, foreign countries. Thank you.
It's been a bad day for me with the books, and now compared to Frankenstein. It's normally a good idea in these debates to go second, because you can sit there and listen to what your opponent says and then think up clever ways in which to ensnare him whilst he's talking. My problem with Anatole, who I should say is rather suspiciously showed up smiling shortly after I was told that my books weren't here. The problem with Anatole is that he basically has covered a great deal of the ground that I would. If the subtitle of my book is The Right Nation, Why America is Different. And to that extent, we go over quite a lot of the same ground. But indeed, even down to the same statistics, one of the religious statistics he used to do with the number of Americans who are religious compared with other people, I had a chart of that once, which I put up in front of Texas, the Robert Large auditorium, and a man from the back noting that only, I think it's 15% of French people think of God as something which they want to embrace on a regular basis, shouted out, "Those French, they're goddamn heathens," and the whole room stood up and cheered. Nevertheless, I'm going to try to poke little holes in what is, to some extent, my own thesis. I was going to look at come at it by looking perhaps at the idea of the West, and to shorten the time frame and to try and look at it as modern politics as opposed to these great themes that we've been going on about in general. And particularly look at the transatlantic alliance, because that, I think, is the core of the question about is America a foreign country. It's also the core of, I suspect, why Cold War studies began. And when I look at the economy, I think I find quite a lot of room to disagree with the general Leven-Micklethwaite thesis. A couple of nights ago, I was reading Chris Patten's book on the economy, on the new book, and he goes to some length, partly to disagree with me, but he goes to some length to point out that in 2003, the very year where we had the biggest amount of disagreements across the Atlantic, American companies actually pumped $87 billion into France and Germany, those two members of the Axis of Weasel. And if you look even further, they put more money into the Netherlands pretty much than they did into the whole of Asia combined. In fact, if you look over the whole 10 years, you can see that American companies put 10 times as much money into the Netherlands as they did into China, twice as much as they put into Mexico. So before you embrace the idea that America is necessarily a foreign country, you have to run up against quite a lot of foreign statistics and the same economic statistics, and the same goes the other way. That said, I normally rejoin that there is actually very clearly differences. There are differences to do with productivity, there are differences to do with labour laws, there are differences, I would argue, perhaps one of the most biggest ones going forward would be to do with demography. If you look at the type of, it's not just a question of America having more people thanks to all that immigration, it's also the type of people. But again, if you compare America with Europe as a whole rather than just Britain, the median age in America is going to stay around 36. In Europe, it's going to rise to 56. Now, I think that is bound to make America a slightly more foreign country. It's bound to come up with a country which is perhaps less interested in stasis, more interested in growth, perhaps much more willing to extend power overseas, and certainly much less concerned by the welfare state. It also means we have to spend a lot more time worrying about saving money for our old age. And I think if you look at the current debates, when you look at these economic differences, if you look at debate over the current account deficit or the savings glut from this end, people, both sides, you see some degree of the blind talking to the, or the deaf talking to the deaf, or whichever way around I should have said it was, to the extent that the Americans repetitively tell the Europeans, you have to get your consumers out there and spending more, and the Europeans reply that the whole problem is the Americans not saving. Even where there is an immediate sense that some degree of collaboration could help, it could go wrong, and in particular on the economy, I'm worried by what I see as the ever-greatening trade tensions. Because in the end, all this question about foreign country, I think in the end, the area where it's going to matter most, certainly if you look back over history, is actually weirdly when it comes down to things like trade. The one area where Europe and America could come apart very seriously is actually back to what I originally said, the pattern argument. If you look back at the end of the last era of globalization, that too was underpinned to some extent by a Western alliance, and it came apart. That said, I still think most of the evidence from the economic sphere points to the idea that America is not that foreign, even allowing for things like the demographics and even allowing for different labor laws. My problems really have much more to do with politics. Now, I think there is, again, to give the other side of the argument, there's quite a respectable case to say, look, actually it isn't that bad. And the first line which the optimists often use is a very simple one, is that, yes, of course, we've had our disagreements over Iraq, over Israel and so on, but we've always had disagreements. Look back to Suez, look back to Cruz, or look back even further. Here's a quotation for you. Out with the Yankees, out with their people, their methods, their lessons, their dances. Let them take back their Fords and their chewing gum. You can almost hear the French accent. In fact, it's from a book called L'Abomination Américaine from the 1930s. There's always been a degree of tension there, and yet we've always patched it up. And I think, again, putting the Atlantic optimist thing in a desperate effort to skewer Anatole and to a large extent myself, I think you can argue that there has been what might be described as a sort of Elton John effect amongst the chancelleries of Europe, certainly since the last election. You might remember just before the last election that the pudgy chanteur announced that if Bush got back in, it would be a complete utter nightmare, the world would basically end, and that people should leave America immediately. Only 15 days after the election, however, there in the West Wing of the White House, accepting some congressional award for bravery in music or something like that, was indeed Sir Elton, and alongside that other well-known cultural conservative, Warren Beatty. I can't remember what he was getting. But my point is that actually there has been, since the last election in particular, some degree of a reckoning that they have to deal with the devil. Paradoxically, that very thing that the neoconservatives always imply about Europeans, that where Machiavellians prepared to do a deal with anybody, in this case came true, is that people were prepared to do deals with Bush. You can talk to people, I remember talking to a guy in the German foreign ministry who said, we have to deal with the devil. On the other side, I think the Americans have gone to some length to get on better with the Europeans. When God made Texans, he didn't include the bone that emits mistakes. All the same, there is at least a tacit admission, if you talk to people in the administration, that there is a need to get on. And I think you can see it, thanks also part to recent events. I think the exquisitely well-timed death of Yasser Arafat allowed some degree of collaboration over Middle East policy. I think what you've seen on Iran once again, you've seen some degree of the Americans being prepared to give the Europeans some degree of head. They've been also, it's quite interesting if you saw the administration people when the head of Iran, when the president of Iran announced his keenness on the rapid destruction of Israel, it's impossible to exaggerate the glee within the White House when that came through, because it confirmed all the things that they've been telling the Europeans for years. And I think you can see it just a tiny bit in the growling of the Russian bear, UCOS, what happened in Ukraine. All these things have gradually, from an optimist point of view, you can argue, pushed the Europeans a little bit back towards the Americans, and in particular, the newer members of the European Union, who all tend to be instinctively far more anti-Russian and more pro-American, those have come back on side. So that would be the sort of Elton John view of it. The Leonard Cohen view, which I suppose I subscribe to slightly more, would be that these are all tend to be rather short-term things which won't necessarily work in the alliance's long-term favour. I think there is still, and Anatole and I could talk about this, there's still a group of people around Bush who regard everything that the Europeans are doing about Iran, for instance, as extremely weak-minded, and that the only long-term solution is some kind of limited military action, perhaps by the Israelis, when it comes to their nuclear threat. I think there are other tensions coming up. The most biggest one, which is apposite because Hu Jintao has just been here and Bush is due to go to China, is indeed China. Most European governments at least quietly want to remove the arms embargo. Americans of virtually every persuasion don't want to. And you can keep on going. I think these are slightly buttressed, or my concerns about these are also exaggerated by the degree of weak leadership on both sides of the Atlantic. You've got the psychodramas here, the succession psychodrama here, the sort of Cain and Abel one of Brown and Blair, which is now slightly complicated by the appearance of an almost electable Tory. In France, you have the Oedipal psychodrama of Sarkozy and Chirac, where the mini-me was meant to rise up and kill the father. but that has been somewhat complicated again by the riots. Meanwhile, in America, again, I'm skating through this very quickly, you can see Bush has had an absolutely disastrous year, whereas a year ago, as the person who'd written a book prophesying the rise of the triumph of conservative America, I was feeling very smug. Even the conservative America has had an absolutely rotten year. Everything that Bush has done within this year pretty much has turned to dust. His attempts to push Social Security have gone wrong. Hurricane Katrina blew a hole in his reputation for crisis management. The Conservative coalition split over the nomination of Harriet Myers, and you had the impeachments of people close to him. I think there's an element in which that's exaggerated. I think as long as Bush hangs on to Rove, and in particular the nomination of Samuel Alito, will help reconcile some of his difficulties. But if you go to Washington, the main debates at the moment are about things like whether Bush and Cheney have actually sort of reached fisticuffs almost. And so from that perspective, there's no doubt that Bush is much weaker. So again, once again, you have this element of weak leadership. And this is, I think, where I really do agree with Anatole quite strongly, is the combination of weak leadership plus events gets that much more dangerous when you think about public opinion on both sides of the Atlantic. Public opinion on both sides of the Atlantic is it couldn't exaggerate more the idea of America as a foreign country. From this side, we tend to regard America as a danger out-dangered only by North Korea and Al-Qaeda. And on the other side, I think it's much more, again, as Anatole stressed, there is a huge amount of people who regard the Europeans as weak-livered, as not entirely there. It's very interesting that just last month, Harris did a poll asking Americans, who do you regard as do you regard the following countries as a close ally of the United States? Britain, it's fair, I think achieved 70% on that. The only other European country to get more than a fifth was Italy, which slithered in with 26%. Nobody else was regarded within that. And so I think there is a deep and abiding suspicion of what's happening in Europe at the moment. And underneath that, I think, and this is inevitably hitting the aims of my book, is basically there is a difference to do with ideology. America has a more conservative ideology, in part because it goes right the way back to some of the things that Anatole was talking about. A country founded by churches and companies had capitalism and religiosity hardwired into its DNA, but also because of the appearance and the drive of a huge conservative movement which we write about in our book. But the logical end of this is America, basically, if you look at any of the attitudinal things from state, any of the big questions of modern politics, from the role of the state to inequality to crime and punishment, you name it, America comes out in a more quote-unquote conservative way. And if you want to see the symbol, I'm not denying there are plenty of liberals in America. Anatole and I spent a long time talking to them. But the overall centre of gravity in American politics is so far to the right that I think it does give some idea to the notion that it is a foreign country. And the man who proved this more tellingly than anyone last year was John Kerry, the man who probably many people in this room hoped would make America a slightly less foreign country, was a man who would not have joined the Kyoto Protocol, who took a position on Israel, which was arguably more pro-Israel than Bush, at least on paper, who would not have joined the International Criminal Court, who believed in a state far, far smaller than anything that Michael Howard would embody, let alone David Cameron, and even beyond that, and I think probably most tellingly of all, took an attitude to hunting, fishing, and shooting that Nicholas Soames might be somewhat embarrassed by. Anyway, against that background, I think this brings in the importance of Katrina and the Paris riots. Up to recently, these would have been purely, I think, domestic problems. But against the background of these attitudinal differences, I think they are extremely important, not because either of them symbolize anything perhaps deep and fundamental about the countries concerned, but, and this is the important bit, they do symbolize something. They symbolize exactly the preconceived notions of one side of the Atlantic about the other. If you look at the coverage of the French riots in the American press, it has been gleeful to the ultimate extent, with people, for instance, pointing out that the rioters in France had a competitive advantage because, unlike the French police, they weren't constrained by the 35-hour working week. It's been more or less open season on everything to do with the French, from their tolerance of Islamo-fascism to the way they treat minorities to their lack of meritocratic society and so on and so on. And I would submit it was pretty much the other way when it came to Katrina over here. And in fact, I think it has changed the dynamic, particularly when it comes back to economic relations, between the two. Because in the old days, pre-Katrina, when Americans came to lecture Europeans about the need to change their economy, the need to push ahead, there was always a theoretical answer from this side of the Atlantic, and that went something like this, that we actually have a belief in a more level society, that we put more role into helping the poor and so on. Post-Katrina, that has become a much more realistic answer. And so the Americanization of the European economy, which has actually been pushing ahead fairly full, may to some extent now be reined in. Anyway, I've tried to skedaddle through things as quickly as possible. I will leave you with one thought, which I think is apposite to the Cold War, from the point of view of being a Cold War debate. I think that particularly at the end of the Cold War, there was a sense of bonding between the two continents, that these were eternal values that people stood for, such as democracy, human rights, and so on, which Bush actually mentioned the other day in his speech. It's now fairly obvious that those things mean different things to different people on both sides of the Atlantic. And rather being two people struggling against each other, I think it's perhaps we could come back to look on it as a time, probably around now, where things began to divide further. We might look on the Cold War not so much as a struggle between the West and the rest of the world, but between more similar to something where two people, two strangers, encounter muggers who attack them and then go out for a celebratory meal afterwards and actually discover they have much less in common than they first thought. Anyway, I will think up more things to try and destroy Anatole and, to a lesser extent, my argument in the discussion. Thank you.
Thanks very much, John. Now, of course, we go to Q&A, and if people want to indicate, I've got a gentleman here and somebody upstairs. So we start here, please.
Yeah. Yes, I think you're really talking about sort of flies and bees just buzzing around. I think fundamentally we're actually very similar to the Americans, and I've put it to you these two ways. One is, if you look at our attitudes and Americans' attitudes towards most things, in terms of free enterprise, etc., we're generally very much more in agreement with Americans than we are with, say, China or Russia, Africa, etc., etc. Secondly, you made reference very early on, Anatole, to having different healthcare systems. But, you know, 10 years ago, President Clinton was trying to introduce a healthcare system. And the fact that the Americans just happen to have an inefficient one, I don't think makes fundamentally that we're that different. So I really do think that we're arguing about sort of bees and little things on the side. And fundamentally, we are actually much more, we have much more in common than we have that separates us. Thank you.
I'll let Anatole and John have a go at that. Anatole, do you want to shout into the mic?
Yeah, I mean, religion, a little thing. Nationalism, small thing there. Attitudes to war, death penalty. Quite different attitudes to, as I've said, you know, questions of social solidarity. These are not little things. The other point, and here, you know, I would endorse very much what John said about the very close economic links between Europe and America. That's entirely true. But that does not mean that America is not a foreign country. To give one obvious example from history, there were enormous levels of investment, sometimes mutual investment, sometimes one-sided investment, of European countries before 1914, who in August 1914 went to war with each other and fought savagely for 4 years. As far as attitudes towards capitalism and the free market are concerned, of course we share, you know, we have a shared belief in this system between America and Europe, basically. But then, as Dr. Fukuyama pointed out, that's true of by far the greater part of the world by now. I mean, different parts of the world may differ in their efficiency when it comes to creating successful markets, but the overwhelming majority of the world believes in these markets, more or less. That links us to America, certainly, but it also links us to countries which I don't think, you know, anybody at all would deny are foreign, like increasingly India, for example. So, simply grounding the notion of that America isn't foreign, that we're not different countries, on the fact that we're all capitalists is historically empty.
Okay, just quickly to follow up on that a bit. Yes, you're right, and that's what I tried to point to as the level. That there are all sorts of things you could point to, like the number of American students you see over here, or vice versa, or the way in which people in Detroit can buy things in Paris across the internet, and vice versa. But I think that's, again, I pick up slightly on Anatole's point, is that one of the interesting things about globalization is it has, by leveling the playing field, or by making some things appear not to matter, it's made other things matter more. One of the interesting things now is if you wander around, people like Anatole and me who followed America for years, in the old days you'd have to explain who the American defense secretary was. Now, thanks to globalization, American politicians are very much in our faces. They're on our television screens. They're very, very present. People know who John Ashcroft is. It goes down quite low. In fact, on the whole, they tend to know often who the American people are rather than some of the British ones, certainly the shadow ones. And that, I think, is the problem, is that you've got, from a European perspective, you have these people very much in your face, and yet you have no real control of them. So globalization, I think, hasn't worked quite so usefully for this relationship as it might work. And the particular thing of trade, always, which is where there were two tragedies in 1913. One, first of all, was the war, and then there was the depression that followed it. And the depression, I'm shortening history slightly, but the level of barriers that shot up, if you go and read a book called The Great Illusion, in 1908, which was basically an Edwardian book, a bestseller, forecasting that one, there'd be no war anymore, and secondly, this huge period of globalization would carry on forever. You very much got, obviously, a different version, the same sentiment you put across. And my worries on trade now are real. I think if you look at the collapse of this boring-sounding Doha round, if you look at what's happening underneath it, we're not going to end up in a 1913 situation. But I think you could see another way in which globalization filters away, which is that people push into regional trade blocks. You end up with the EU looking ever more to the east and America looking down to NAFTA and CAFTA. So it's a very long-winded answer to your question.
There's a gentleman upstairs there, yeah. And I've come down. Thank you. Yeah, please, yeah.
Yes, John McCain just passed a bill in the Senate to ban torture, and Bush and Cheney effectively came out and said they would veto it, effectively standing up for torture. And you couldn't imagine any European government taking the stance. Do you think that's an insignificant difference, or do you think it's a major difference in the change of values? Thank you.
So, is Europe against torture?
Well, I wrote a leader in last week's Economist condemning Bush and Cheney on this, but I think it'd be going a little bit far to saying they're claiming they're standing up for torture.
Yeah.
It's also worth noting that this, not quite torture, but it did actually occur at the same time as Blair was trying to ram through 90 days without any right to a court. So I think, obviously, America has been deeply impacted by 9/11. That's self-evident. It'd be interesting to see what the effect of similar terrorist effects on civil liberties in Europe.
Yes, from a historical perspective, of course, as a European, what one should be hesitant to say that, you know, torture is American and torture is not European. I was, you know, I've always been greatly amused by when General Ossaret, you may know this story in France, came out with his memoirs, saying, which, as far as I was aware, everybody knew, which was that the French state had condoned torture in Algeria. The French elites had to claim to be shocked by this revelation. So I'm not sure that, you know, innately there's a great difference. The difference perhaps comes more in a certain American legalism. In Europe, or certainly in Britain, you know, the classic phrase, the British officer, carry on, Sergeant Major, do what you have to do, you know. But don't, for God's sake, write it down, you know, and turn it into a rule. Nonetheless, there has been, since 9/11, but it also comes from a deep tradition in parts of American culture, something reflected. It was an off-the-record statement, so I can only say that he was a very senior former legal official of the Bush administration, who was asked why, you know, the classic European question, why America had not responded to 9/11 by police and intelligent means and brought the people who'd planned it to trial. And he replied like this: even if we could have caught and sentenced to death a few or a few dozen people, that would not have been sufficient compensation for our culture for the thousands of deaths that it suffered on 9/11. Now that used to be known as the lex talionis, the law of retaliation, and it was explicitly followed by many people on the American frontier in the past, and it's passed on, I think, and come back since 9/11. Now, whether that makes them so very different from us, I don't know, because it could depend very much on how much terrorist attack Europe comes under. You know, we shouldn't be too smug about our values from that point of view. But certainly, at present, it does mark a difference.
I was living in Northern Ireland in 1972, and I think they were saying some things about torture by the British in Northern Ireland in 1972.
Absolutely.
So, you know, so nobody's got clean hands, I should imagine. The gentleman up there, please. Yeah, please. Would you pass that over? Yeah, I'll just take some from upstairs and I'll come downstairs. Yeah, please.
Just have a question. If you have any observations on the American media, I'm often struck watching and reading it how much the extent to which it's the political opinion is compressed within a very narrow range. And just as an illustration of that, I think Noam Chomsky has only written two articles in the New York Times in the last 30 years, and certainly been far many more than that in the Guardian in the last 5 years.
Okay, so Noam Chomsky has not been on Fox News lately. Would you like to explain why, Anatole?
Well, no. I mean, that's just it. It's not Fox News. It's the New York Times and the LA Times and the Washington Post, all papers still calling themselves, you know, basically centrist liberal. But where one reads, as you know, I mean, the most extreme chauvinist sentiment sometimes from people like Charles Krauthammer or Sapphire. But exactly, you never see, you know, representatives of the American left, which is both, I mean, it's also because the American left is naturally much weaker, but it also does reflect, undoubtedly, a narrower range of opinion. I mean, in my book, I connect this to some extent. It's a phenomenon, by the way, that has been observed since Tocqueville and has been very strongly commented on by many American writers, including, most notably or surprisingly perhaps, Senator William Fulbright, who was at the time the chairman of the American of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but this came out of his opposition to the Vietnam War and his feeling that in the run-up to the Vietnam War, because of certain fundamental American myths, nationalist myths, if you will, many of the key issues about what America was getting itself into were not discussed. Now, I was, I must say, horrified to find that this repeated itself in the run-up to the Iraq War. That the debate, you know, in the mainstream media was indeed very narrow, and all manner of things, not out of world history, but out of America's own history, we're excluded from it. So I can only agree with you there.
I'm going to disagree with Anatole, and also to disagree with the questioner or the premise of it. If you wandered around most of America, if you went into what we call the right nation, and you talked about media bias, the mere idea that you could say that it's because it's too right wing would strike most people as utterly absurd. Charles Krauthammer, who Anatole just cited, had a wonderful comment once where he said Rupert Murdoch. Was a brilliant businessman who spotted, when he set up Fox News, spotted a tiny niche in the population. So it's probably a tiny niche, 50% of the population. The view from conservative America is very simple, is that America is run by a liberal media establishment from the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and it's certainly democratic leaning. And then any of those papers, no mainstream American paper, with the exception of the Wall Street Journal, has endorsed Republicans. It's been pretty solidly Democratic. As for ABC, NBC, CBS, they once again are controlled by what conservative America rightly or wrongly sees as the liberal media elite. And so I think from their perspective, the idea that Noam Chomsky can't get into it, the rights and wrongs of Noam Chomsky, they would regard that as very small compared with the difficulty of conservatives, as they saw it, getting to any of these things before things like Fox turned up. And although you might dislike Fox News, although you might dislike Rush Limbaugh, they are bottom-up things. They're built from the bottom, with conservative America getting increasingly angry and annoyed about it. But there's no doubt that in terms of the American media, the high citadels of it, from publishers to broadcasters to radio things and so on, is completely controlled by what would normally be described as the liberal media.
Can I say
yeah,
something?
Sure.
Yes, but you just said yourself that, of course, the entire, once again, if we're talking about America as a country, which is different from Britain, but the entire system, including the liberals, is centred much more on the right. So that in that sense, not so much, and here I wasn't talking about domestic policy, where there are real disagreements, especially, of course, in the area of morality, social values, and so forth. But in the area of foreign policy, I have found, fewer fundamental disagreement.
I think there was a subservience by the media to the, including the ones you cited. After 9/11, there was such an enormous, rightly or wrongly, such an enormous rallying around the flag that you did find the New York Times and so on rallying. But God knows it's stopped now.
Not entirely. I would say that it's, of course, you're dead right. I mean, now people are attacking Bush ferociously, and of course, strikingly, some of the most cogent attacks have come from within the Republican camp, Scowcroft, Larry Wilkerson, and so forth. But, I mean, I don't know whether this makes America very foreign, because no doubt every country finds it difficult to analyse some of the real fundamentals of its system, and that is no doubt true of Britain and European countries as well. But if you're looking for, it's a key problem for the Democrats today, that the Bush administration has also become much more pragmatic in its second term, as you mentioned, much more restrained, much more pragmatic. Where now can the Democrats oppose the Bush administration, not in terms of attacking their record of incompetence, but in drawing up a very different philosophy? For example, a more limited approach to American global hegemony or leadership, not abandoning that leadership, but scaling it back in certain areas. They can't, not really. You see very, very, very few suggestions of that in the American mainstream. You have to go, at least to the edges of the mainstream. Once again, on the right, the American Conservative, for example, or on the left, The Nation.
Yeah,
but not the New York Times, not the Washington Post.
Why they need outside commentators like Anatole.
Exactly.
You basically need Brits to explain America to America. That's what you're saying.
Our desperate pitch.
That's yes.
And they should pay us.
Keep paying. Lady here, please.
I would like to hear your comments on approach to multilateralism and intergovernmental organizations and different approaches to UN, United Nations reform. Since we're living in these times of very clear display of efforts by the Americas to cripple the UN and several other things that were created towards the last century by mostly continental European initiatives, how you perceive that the rest of the world where multilateralism counts for Latin America or Africa or Asia, how people feel very frustrated about Britain not taking their position to uphold legality and Geneva Convention and humanitarianism and international law, how people feel very betrayed when Britain takes opportunistic view to get oil contracts in Iraq, Afghanistan, instead of upholding values that people would like to. Thank you.
It's difficult to hear upstairs. The broad question was about multilateralism and the United Nations. I think that was the central kind of question you were driving at, and America's role towards that. Is that a reasonable summary? Yeah. Okay. John, do you want to pick up on that one first?
There is a basic difference. As America, to be crass about it, doesn't like the United Nations very much, and the Europeans do. I mean, again, there are historical parallels with this. Kagan, the neoconservative, makes actually the very good point, is if you go back 120 years ago, we were the superpower, and America was trying desperately to constrain us by our multilateral organisations. So they were setting up rules of the sea, etc. And we were saying, bugger off, we've got warships and gunboats and that. Sorry, I'm sure we put it more politely than that, but we basically said...
We certainly wouldn't.
No, we wouldn't.
but we said that wasn't, you know, that wasn't the way that the world was meant to be. And that tension between a superpower and the rest of the world trying to sort of tie it down by multilateral organisations is bound to survive. I think there has been the lesson of Iraq to some extent has been that America does need multilateral things. It would be the neoconservatives, I mean not just multilateral but Europe, you know, the neoconservatives made the case that basically you could ignore Europe particularly because one, they didn't matter, they weren't strong enough, and secondly, they'd come along anyway. Well, France and Germany conspicuously have not come along in Iraq in any big way. And secondly, it has mattered. You know, America would have done much better in Iraq, whatever the rights and wrongs of the whole thing, if it had had broader support. And so there's antagonism there, and there's always going to be a more different relationship between the superpower and the United Nations. But there has been a slight amelioration.
I would say that formal multilateralism, legalist multilateralism, if you like, in terms of a willingness to follow decisions of the UN, is to all intents and purposes dead in America now, yep, in both parties. And you mentioned how John Kerry wouldn't have done many things, yep, most things either, any differently. But you're equally right that it is now very generally recognised in the American establishment and more widely in America that America needs allies. So the question is, you know, can America move back to a sort of informal, pragmatic multilateralism a la Eisenhower or Truman?
You know, or Clinton.
Or Clinton, yes. But the question there, of course, is, and Bush rhetorically and diplomatically is already doing that with reference to Europe, the question, and not just for this administration but for the American system as a whole, is, are they prepared to make real concessions on critical issues where they at least partially disagree with other countries or other potential allies in order to get them on board, in order to make them allies? Now, that question is still very much open. But clearly, on a range of key issues, the United States is going to have to do that if it wants to bring, you know, to bring countries really on board. And in the context of the Middle East, I would say that to some extent in Europe, the Americans have been chasing a red herring, because there's, outside to the area of aid, there's very little that Europe can or will do anyway. The allies that they desperately need, of course, are Muslim allies. But to get them really on board, they're going to have to make concessions. Can they do it?
John, did you want to come back on that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
Okay, there was a question over here, a chap in blue, who I know is from the United States of America. So we'll now prove something about foreignness or something else. Eugene.
Thanks so much. My name is Eugene Kogan. I'm a master's candidate here in international relations. I'm just thinking, sitting here and thinking about the title, if I may bring you both of you back to the title. If I may bring you back to the title of the conversation here, I'm thinking of the word foreign specifically, because it's not different country, it's actually just foreign country, which suggests a much deeper sense of U.S. being an alien nation. And my confusion, my sort of question about it is that for all of the openness of the U.S. system, I would like you to challenge me on the point that it is very open, probably one of the most open political systems in the world, for all of its openness, it's still a foreign country. And specifically, if I may ask both of you, I mean, while working in Washington earlier this summer, I heard Mike Lind, Dr. Levin's colleague at the New America Foundation, argue that the Iraq War, quote unquote, punctured the mystique of American power. And in that sense, my specific question, in addition to the broader one, is would you say that the events of the past several years have rendered America a less foreign country than before, at least in that narrower sense of American power being more intelligible in the context of Iraq? Thanks so much.
Thanks.
It's a difficult one.
I've seen John's notes here. He's got a question mark.
Hesitation.
I'll give the answer to that one. If I can. He's down there, my students.
I find, from the point of view of openness, I find America is a fascinating picture at the moment because it is a very open system, naturally, certainly compared to most systems in the world, and to a degree, you know, even compared to European countries, which are often far more provincial, closed in, than the kind of image of a united and open Europe would suggest. It's also, I mean, this is not really about the theme of this conversation, but it's also, I feel, becoming an increasingly congealed system. What the American system sometimes, but don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting a revolution is on the way, but has come a bit to remind me of 18th century France, in that here's a country with enormous potential, tremendous power, tremendous dynamism, but has a political system which, if you look at the composition of the Senate, if you look at the patronage system that I talked about, if you look at the way in which the Senate allocates public funds, I mean, really, once again, I mean, this earmarking system, I don't know whether to call it 18th century, but I mean, it's disastrous in terms of state efficiency. And a whole range of things which, you know, I think ought to be wide, and of course the system of electing presidents, all of which risk in future a series of, I think, very severe breakdowns, and we've already seen one over Katrina, but which it doesn't look as if the existing system can remedy. And, I mean, how far that contributes in turn to an inability, you know, to take advice or to hold serious consultation with outside critics or analysts, I don't know, but I just was taking up something you said about openness. On the subject of Michael Lind and his statement that it's punctured American power. Now, for the moment, that is absolutely true. I mean, quite clearly, America simply does not have a second army with which to invade a lot of places, and the uniformed military have made it very clear, not that they really even needed to do so, to the political establishment, that if they get into another major war, they will have to reintroduce the draft. They will simply have no choice. I mean, there won't be the soldiers. This is related in turn to the inability to raise taxes. You know, so you have a system which, to some degree, is beginning to suffer from some very classical symptoms of imperial decline. You know, you can't raise taxes, therefore you can't raise more soldiers, and, to take a Chinese parallel, you can't repair the dikes, the levees. You know, that's how you lose the mandate of heaven, sooner or later. An interesting question, though, is, and so, you know, that's a key reason why the Bush administration has become so much more cautious and pragmatic. But a key question is, will this remain the case? And will it remain the case, above all, if America comes under attack again? Because, after all, we have seen this once before in modern American history, as a result of the Vietnam War. America became quite considerably more cautious after that. And then two things happened. One was that the Soviet Union basically went on the geopolitical offensive. And of course, plus unrelated things, the revolution in Iran. And so America once again geared itself up to respond. The second thing, though, was that along came Ronald Reagan, who was elected, for example, in the view of Gary Wills, very much to, well, in the view of so many people, Gary, but to heal the wounds of Vietnam, but to heal them very much by forgetting what happened in Vietnam, forgetting the lessons of Vietnam, which worked with tremendous success, I think. So once again, for the moment, America has become
very much more cautious. That's entirely true. My question is whether the American establishment has become fundamentally wiser as a result of Iraq, or whether some of what I would see as the same illusions, basically, about American power and America's role in the world, illusions stemming from the nature of American nationalism, will continue and will be reawakened again if, God forbid, America is attacked again. But I should say that from this point of view, I talk very much in my book about America's great self-correcting mechanism, which I see at work today and which one has seen so many times through history. Harry Truman said during the McCarthy episode, we've been through this before, America has come under threat and there have been periods of hysteria, and then we've returned, to balance, to moderation, to pragmatism, and America didn't go to hell, and it's not going to hell now. That would be very much my belief today, as long as America isn't attacked again. That's what really worries me.
Just coming on your thing about the foreign, these are entirely instinctive replies rather than necessarily accurate. But you asked about whether a foreign country or an alien nation. I think America as a whole is, as I said, argued largely, is seen as a foreign country. In terms of alien nation, I think that the bit where that rings a chord of truth for me is particularly with that, the bit of the middle, that with what we call the Right Nation in our book, to give it a desperate plug, even though there aren't any books. It's conservative America. It's that bit of America. That is the bit that Europeans don't visit. They don't go to conservative America unless it's to kill wildlife or buy horses. It's that they go to Los Angeles, they go to San Francisco, or they go to the East Coast cities, and they fly over this vast area, and it sticks out as clear as anything if you look at the map of the last election. And what I think has happened, in terms of you then asked, has it generally become more so or less? And there I think there's an interesting split. On the one hand, this resurgent conservative America and the fact it's pushed American policy in a particular angle has certainly made that sort of alien nation part of America much more real. On the other hand, there has been a sort of coming to terms, I think, in Europe, where most Europeans jumped to the excuse when Bush first appeared that effectively he was some sort of freak who was elected by a small proportion of people and cheated his way in. What the last election showed was that Bush actually won more votes than anyone else. He won more votes than any Democrat's done for 40 years. And God knows, you can cite endless statistics, is that he does represent something very real in America. And my instinctive approach is that many Europeans, rightly or wrongly, do see that as an alien thing. But they are beginning to understand it. I mean, the BBC, is a very good... They never knew or indeed reported about this. As in, to be fair, the New York Times and the Washington Post didn't do much stuff on it either. They didn't. This side of America, they didn't know about. But straight off the election, there was a sudden sort of outpouring on the BBC of lots of pictures of evangelical Christians going about their way, and arguably they swung it too far because they weren't quite as important as the BBC was making out. But that type of thing, I think, does have an effect. Anyway, that's my answer to that particular bit.
Okay, there's a question up here, and then I'll bring another people down here. Yeah.
Right, I just wanted to ask, because both speakers alluded to the fact there's a growing rift between Europe and America. I just want to know what the speakers think, whether this rift is actually going to increase over the coming years and decades, especially in light of the rise of China. I mean, what are the views here in regards to this particular...
Okay, I'm going to bring in a question down. I'm going to take some more. There's a question here, please. We'll take, because we've got about another 5 minutes to run, so I just want to take two or three together. Yeah. You have to flick it on, please. Yeah.
Just a short question was also mentioned before through the transatlantic partnership, especially the transatlantic security partnership, and how to tackle future challenges common together, Europe and in the US. I see two points and short questions, because the first development is diverging views on how to tackle these things, use of force and everything else between the US and Europe. The second thing is that you have less and less capabilities on the European side, maybe except Britain, to tackle these things together with the US. So the question I have is, if these things continue, these developments, how does that bode in the future for the security partnership with the US, and especially for the one institution that is essential for the security partnership with the US, is the NATO?
Okay, that's two transatlantic kind of questions and an addendum with China. We'll take one more down here. The gentleman with the beard had his hand up earlier on. Well, it was the man with the beard in front, but there's two beards, so... the
The man with the beard with the microphone in his hand.
Okay. yes, we are comparing Europe and the US, but we are taking a rather British point of view here, which is quite understandable. After all, this is where we are. Both the countries are extremely unique. Britain, or the England, was last conquered in 1066, as you know, and has not been conquered since. It's absolutely unique for any country in Europe. The only war irreversibly that it has lost has been against its own diaspora, the United States. And the United States has never lost a single war anywhere. Sorry, am I?
That's all right, it's the Scots nationalists at the back here. Okay. My Scottish friends are having a go at this one, quite rightly so.
Okay, the US has simply not lost a war anywhere. It does not know what occupation is. It does not know what it means to be defeated. It has simply never experienced that part of history. Incidentally, I come from former Yugoslavia, born in Belgrade, the one capital in Europe bombed by both Nazis and NATO, and I can compare the two. And I would today a million times rather have Mussolini fascists, I say fascists, Benito Mussolini in Kosovo, than the British and the Americans, who have wiped out all the Christian churches. Never happened under Mr. Mussolini. Okay. The issue here, I'm sorry, since I want to ask a question. Okay. To what extent can the countries here be an example? The experience of two generations and two world wars in Europe has been no intervention in other countries' internal affairs. This is what two generations have learned of basically an auto-genocide in Europe. And we are now completely and totally ignoring this from the United States, and there seem to be no resistance anywhere in Europe, least of all from the UK.
Okay, thanks very much. And I'll take one more question from the lady at the back there who's had her hand up for a long time. I'm trying to get everybody in. Okay, please. Thank you.
Yes, I just wanted to ask a question about something you only alluded to, and that's the role of federalism in American politics, because I think a lot of European misreading of certain key aspects of American policy and practice, especially on the environment, is due to a lack of understanding of the way the federal system operates. And for example, in relation to, as I said, environmental policy, there have been very significant differences in approaches amongst the states, and they have significant powers and important impacts.
Okay, I'm going to take one final question from the top. Who had their hand up at the top there? Sorry, I'm trying to... Somebody, anybody there, yeah. Who's got the microphone?
I'm going to ask a quick question, but I think this guy's had his hand up, so maybe we can combine
it
really quickly. Just a quick note on human rights. And American exceptionalism. Eleanor Roosevelt, I think, might have been really shocked at, with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to think that, realize perhaps that there's this paradox with the fact that these liberal and ideals get spread around the world, yet something that's really fundamental with American culture is that this, we take popular sovereignty and very seriously, I suppose. And it comes into a serious and deep conflict with international oversight and human rights ideals. So your comments on this paradox.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'll take one last one here. The chap in the middle with the white, white sweater on. Sorry, I'm trying to bring as many people as possible. And then we'll have a round robin, that's it, and then we'll go over to the final comments from the two speakers. Yeah, please, your last one, sorry.
Thanks. Yeah. Pretty much my question goes primary to...
Speak loudly and into the mic.
Sorry, excuse me. A question just deals with the sort of break between conservative and liberal, democratic and conservative sort of break within the United States. And there's been more attempts lately to create a bipartisan sort of relationship between the two. What do you think are the sort of fruit? Do you think these are positive sort of, do you think these will pan any fruit? And this more goes towards the New America Foundation and their sort of work as well.
Okay, now I think we've got enough there. You can answer what you want. Right. Anatole, you spoke first, so I think it's up to you, John.
Right. Gosh, conservatives and liberals getting on better. Answer, yes. They're the McCain group of 14 senators who sort of argued about filibusters, there's a little sign of that, but basically they still hate each other and probably want to get each other. You could argue even just to throw a dog at Anatole, is that I think the New America Foundation is a good example of something which tried to keep out of politics, but is sort of all tried to take a thing where it didn't get too identified with one side or the other, but probably rightly or wrongly has got slightly put into the liberal bit by conservatives, rightly or wrongly, which you can come at me. On human rights versus foreign policy, I think basically that's a lot of all big powers. There's an endless series about, you know, do you back the dictatorship, which is merely bad, against the dictatorship, which is evil? How do you deal with those things? I mean, what was intriguing to me about the torture question was that seemed to me like something which Bush could grab hold of and say, look, this is something I can unalterably stand against, and so it's a failed opportunity. On the use of force and less technical capacity, I think that's absolutely right. Anton and I were talking about on the telephone a couple of days ago. To my unskilled eyes, you know, one of the biggest things the Europeans could do is to build up some degree of force or some coordinated in a way which makes a difference, because at the moment there aren't reasons for Americans to listen to the Europeans, at least when it comes to the aggressive side of wars. The Europeans matter a great deal in peacekeeping, but there isn't, you know, virtually every statistic you see, the Gulf is growing bigger, not smaller. So I think that is something the Europeans could look at, given everything that we've said. On the question of the gentleman who accused us both of taking a British point of view, I actually think, self-defensively, that actually we went to unusual lengths to relentlessly compare Britain with Europe, compare America with Europe as a whole, rather than particularly Britain. The interesting question with Britain is that actually we're stuck. Is that if you look at virtually all the attitudinal things, which if you look at our foreign policy, a lot of that is leaning towards America. If you look at the deeper attitudinal things, when you compare America against the rest of the world, we tend to line up when it comes to things like patriotism slightly, but particularly religion, role of the state, all those type of deeper emotions. We tend to line up on the European side, which therefore puts the British in an odd position. On the federal system and environmental differences, again, you're obviously right. Blair, I noticed yesterday, tried to make a slightly big fuss out of the fact that although he totally failed to persuade the Americans to endorse Kyoto, it's true that various states have gone for it. So there is all gone for some version of carbon trading and stuff like that. And I think that was about all I could do, so I want to hand over to Anatole.
On it being a British position, I should say, you know, by way of some kind of self-defense, that my book was actually very deliberately based upon American traditions and American scholars. And one of the explicit points of the book was to try and reawaken interest in a number of people who are very little read today outside academia and ought to be. I mean, even Fulbright has been largely forgotten. I mean, what he actually said. Hofstadter, Lewis Hartz, C.Van Woodward, all you know, Americans, but who had an element of critical detachment from the American cultural tradition, which allowed them to write, I think, you know, works of enduring contemporary value. When it comes to, you said, of course, this contradiction in the policy of every great power, between its values and its, you know, pragmatic great power interests, that's entirely true. I think that perhaps there's a particular problem for America, which is that because the rhetoric is more extreme, generally, when it comes to freedom and democracy and human rights, therefore American crimes, which in my view are not greater than those of many European democracies in the past. I mean, my God, if you've read these books about the British in Kenya in the 1950s. But of course, because America goes in for this language, it makes the hypocrisy seem greater. And of course, that's particularly true if you try to found an entire geopolitical program, if you try to make the core of your strategy in a given region spreading democracy and freedom, as the Bush administration has done with regard to the Muslim world, and as the Democrats have accepted, by the way, then what happens in Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo, or the support, you know, in so many cases for authoritarian regimes against popular movements, of course, becomes not just a question of hypocrisy, but it undermines the entire strategic effort. So that seems to me the critical problem. Will we grow apart or closer together in future? For me, that depends critically on, as Macmillan put it so famously, events and how we both react to them. Now, a possible clash with China, that's important, or just the development of relations with China. Most important, however, it seems to me quite clearly in the short to medium term, is terrorism. Does terrorism in Europe drive us closer to America or further apart? How do we answer the question, which is after all critical to the issue of alliance and the NATO alliance? The central question is, does the alliance with America now contribute to our security, as it has for the past 50 years, including in the Balkans after the end of the Cold War, or is it now a factor which diminishes our security by drawing increased terrorism down on our heads? That will be intimately related to what America actually does in the Middle East and in strategic terms, and how European publics, British publics, view what it does. And of course, terrorism in Europe, does it make us more afraid of being with the Americans, or does it increase a sense of sharing values, sharing security interests with the Americans? I believe the answer to these questions is open. It's genuinely open, and it will depend critically on a whole set of future factors. In the longer term, there is, of course, the environment. And now we're talking in terms of decades. But if environmental threats increase and become more and more visible, does that have the effect of changing the American system radically and bringing Europe and America closer together, or does it increase resentment of America in Europe? Once again, open. The American federal system, from that point of view, absolutely critical. And central to America's functioning as a society. Don't get me wrong, when I say the system is becoming congealed, there are also good reasons for that, why it has to be, because it is such a complicated federal country. Finally, what was I going to say? Yes, one thing on Americans not having... Oh, well, first, New America. We have indeed gone into opposition. It's worth remembering, however, that we certainly haven't joined the Democrats. Indeed, if anything, New America remains closer, or has become closer, to the Eisenhower Republicans, the traditional Republicans like Scowcroft, who are criticizing Bush very much from a standpoint of traditional Republican realism. I mean, a much more restricted, but closely associated with belief in a much more restrained use of American power, great skepticism about democratic messianism, and so forth. But New America was founded to a considerable degree already in 1999 by dissident Republicans reacting against Newt Gingrich. So we've certainly gone into opposition, but not party political opposition. And that reflects a very important thing about America, with profound implications, perhaps, for the future, which is that the key debates on foreign policy are not, insofar as they ever did, but today they're certainly not, in my view, taking place along party lines. Some of the most radical opposition to the Bush administration now comes from within the Republican Party, whereas, of course, the effective neoconservative program, in a milder form, has tremendous support from Democrat intellectuals, the so-called Democrat hawks. So this could take some very surprising and interesting forms in future. We don't know what way it will go. Finally, on America lacking a sense of defeat. Now, that is true, no doubt, of America as a whole, as a nation, although it was fought to a standstill in Korea, and in effect was defeated in Vietnam, even if it never lost a battle in the field. But there are, of course, many sections of American society which know profoundly what it is to be defeated. Now, that, of course, historically was most obviously true of the white South, but at an even deeper level, it's true of the blacks, it's true of the growing Latino population, and it's true of a great many of the American immigrant populations from Europe. The Jews, the Armenians, the Poles, a great list of ethnic Americans who, insofar as they remember their previous national histories, have a deep sense of defeat. Now, I think a critical question for America in future is, up to now, generally, these groups have reflected their past sense of defeat by identifying with American power and gaining, if you like, a new confidence, overcoming past humiliation by merging themselves in the sense of American victory, American success. The Irish Americans are a great example of that. I think it's a very interesting question for the future, whether this will go on being the case, or whether, in fact, influenced by some of these new groups, racial minorities, will in fact have the effect of making America understand at a deeper level, some of the historical humiliations, the resentments, the nature of extremism, or at least distrust of American power in other nations, which comes out of that, out of those national experiences. It hasn't happened yet, but if it happened in future, it could be a real source, I think, of a certain reconciliation between America and the rest of the world, which I hope very much will happen, because just to end, there may have seemed to be a certain anti-American edge to some of what was said here, but I remain actually a great believer in American values, and I would like to see them play once again a positive role in the world.
Okay, before I move a vote of thanks to our two speakers and indeed to yourselves for coming this evening, can I just make a quick announcement about our next lecture? As you know, the Cold War Studies Centre is we're a rolling kind of circus, really. Anatole mentioned neoconservatism, and by chance, would you believe, next week, almost the same place, indeed the same place and the same time, we have a debate on neoconservatism and the origins of the new American empire. But I think probably the two of the most important writers on the phenomenon, Professor Ann Norton from the University of Pennsylvania and Dr. Stefan Halper. Secondly, I'm afraid I have to say this once again, John, because I have to say it. Anatole's book is on sale outside, and for a minor fee to the Cold War Studies Center, paid to Svetozar Razhak over there, he will sign it for you. Thank you again for coming this evening to what I thought was a terrific discussion, and particularly to thank our two speakers, John and Anatole, for precipitating a fantastic debate. Thank you.